So, John, thank you for coming on the show. We have identical faces.
Yes, we do.
This will be proof for once and for all that we are not the same person.
Well, only if there's a photo of this goes out.
We must remember to take a photo of it. I was once
doing Old Rope and Phil Nichol, a man I've known for a decade and gigged with probably 30 or 40 times, came up to me and thanked me so much for having him on my podcast.
I had a similar experience with Jeff Innocent, lovely Jeff, who I'll be very keen to get on this show, when he... Now, no, actually, I'm telling your story. I've told this to other people, but did you not tell me that Jeff had said something to you? He was like, why is Goldsmith being a bit off with me? Like, me and Jeff had a really good night out in Liverpool once, complete random situation. Maybe he told it to me. I think he saw you at a gig and was almost about to have a word and go, why are you giving me the cold shoulder? What about that great night out we had recently?
Right.
And then he realised that
I see
that you weren't me.
I always get the impression with Jeff Innocent that he's about to have a word. I'm never quite sure why.
I think he does. Probably, if I were Jeff Innocent, I would be quite pleased with that.
Yeah, that feeling definitely.
Going ahead of me. What was the other worst moment of your career? Just while we're eviscerating John at the beginning of this
that
podcast.
That was when that was Skinny Love, my first show, and I was outside the caves on the cobbles, and someone had just... I can't remember who it was. I can remember who it was, I'm not going to say. Someone had just got Mock the Week, and I was sort of congratulating them through gritted teeth. And then my agent called at the time and said, I've managed to get you a spot in a Jongleur's New Act competition. And I was doing my first hour in Edinburgh, and I'd been a full-time comic for 4 years, and I just put the phone down and was like, all right, going to go for one of my Edinburgh cries.
Yeah, right.
And that was just, bad. So then I moved to London, stopped doing some of the gigs I'd been doing sort of outside of London, and would take the sort of the unpaid spots and doing stuff like Old Rope was great. The new material night that Tiff Stevenson runs was a hugely useful thing. And the first gig I did in London, I think, was Old Rope. And I did a bit, and Dave Gorman and Mark Lamar were in the audience, and I heard Mark Lamar laugh at my bit, and I was like, well, this is why.
Mm.
This is why, because I've never done a gig with other comics in the audience who weren't on the bill ever. And this is after like 7 years. So you're there thinking, well, of course I needed to be here. What was the point in...
Like, psychologically, you mean? You needed to...
No, physically, you needed to be in London.
Right, right.
What's the point in holding up in Bristol saying, well, I should be getting all this stuff because I'm as good as all those people, when you just come back from a pub in Canesham? And it all becomes ludicrous. And then after that, you sort of deal with this grief, thinking, why didn't I do this 5 years ago? And then you get over that, and then things start to sort of take off a bit. I'm not saying that if you come to London, you'll suddenly get where you want to be, but it certainly gives you a fighting chance.
And you, I suppose something that crops up from time to time on this show is people say, I remember Stephen Grant saying, oh yeah, you should definitely make all of your mistakes outside of London, because then when you arrive in London, people don't know you, and the first time they see you, you're smashing the tits off a gig, rather than...
Did he use that exact phrase?
He didn't. And as I said it, I wondered why that phrase has leapt to mind. My point is, doing really well in a room where people are getting to see you and go, oh, who's this guy?
Yeah.
He's clearly really good.
That's absolutely true. I remember thinking when I lived in Bristol, thank God I started here. Because when I started, I had a totally different sort of style and different way of writing. But then what I didn't do was, when I found that sort of the voice that I have now, I stayed in Bristol because my rent was 250 quid a month in a lovely Georgian flat, and I could get home in time for last orders and take all of these easy decisions. But then, you come to London and do okay at gigs, I suppose. I wouldn't say I came to London and smashed the tits off loads of gigs necessarily, but it makes absolute sense now.
Let's talk about that notion of you finding your voice, because that's definitely something that I have seen in your work in the last few years when I've seen your bits and pieces, heard you on the podcast as well. That you have, I feel like you're a really good example of someone who has owned some of their character traits.
Mm-hmm.
How can I say this? I was having a chat with James Acaster a couple of years ago, and I was saying, I was the boss. James the boss Acaster. And I think I was saying that I was worrying, I was mithering about, you know, I just don't know. I don't know if I've got the
mithering.
Confidence. Yeah,
that's a very northern phrase.
Yeah,
are you from the north?
No,
yeah.
I'm.
You just influences from all over the country.
I'm a verbal magpie, John. Lived in lots of different places, like Christoph Lambert in Highlander.
Whoa, good reference. They're doing a special screening of Highlander at the Prince Charles Cinema with a Q&A with Lambert himself.
Hello, wow, that's pretty cool. But I notice you call him Lambert and not Lambert.
Yeah, Christopher Lambert. Sorry, I got distracted.
That's quite all right.
Highlander.
No, I was wondering if we were
it's
going
a great
to
film.
See. It's a great film. Isn't it a great film? How much of it can you speak along with? Are you
from the dawn of time, they came moving silently down through the ages.
Very good. Very good. I can get the occasional quote along the way, but you struck me as someone who would probably know all of it.
Father, I am but a worm. That's the Kurgan.
The Kurgan, love it.
Oh, Connor. That's his wife, Heather.
You are well known, I think, for being an excellent compere.
Thank you very much. That's very kind. Many other excellent compares are available.
Does that... I'm a pretty handy compere, and I suppose part of me is slightly saddened by the fact that I'm a good compere, because I think, you know, but I want to be the guy doing the set. I don't want to have the whole, do you know what I mean? I feel a sort of a, like, a, that's, I didn't get into it to be a good compere. Is there anything of that for you, or are you?
I'd say that was certainly the case when I was stagnating in Bristol for those years, very much the case, because comparing came quite naturally to me. So I could do it without thinking or preparing. I could not think about the gig until 5 minutes before I went on stage and forget about it as soon as I came off. And whilst that's all well and good, if your main goal for that day is to watch traffic cops all afternoon and get pissed after the gig, which, you know, is fine if you want to do that. But after a while, there's another part of you which isn't getting nourished. So then moving to London, there's only two gigs I compare now in London. I wouldn't compare a gig outside of London unless it's absolutely super bunts, like really top dollar, like a festival or something. It might be quite fun to do that. You're not the focus, and no one goes along to watch people doing gigs and thinks, oh, we'll book the compare for that TV show because that bit of banter he had with the front row was hilarious.
Yeah.
What use is that? Don't do any... If ever you're trying out for anything on telly, never improvise because they cannot use it.
Yeah.
That said, I would never change that because that has informed more of my comedy than anything else. And I never feel better than when I'm riffing with an audience. That's the best feeling, I think.
Is there that seems like there's a bit of a contradiction between those two.
Very complex man.
Well, as we're learning. The contradiction between those two states, like, you really, your favourite moments are flying by the seat of your pants, improvising well.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you said, effectively what
you
said.
Yeah, in terms of like,
And yet what you want is to be booked for TV shows in which that you won't be given the opportunity to do that.
Sure. Well, you can do that on a, you know, the best moments in a lot of panel shows come from when everyone's improvising with each other. So there is a room for that. But in those important moments where you need to display yourself, you have to be doing your absolute dynamite gear. You know, you have to be doing, and don't make any bones about it, you have to absolutely be the best you can be with the material you have over the course of, I don't know, 5-10 minutes or whatever, in a showcase or in an audition or whatever. Because that's what, when you step to the mic on Mock the Week.
Okay, that's what we're doing.
You can't point to the guy in the front row and go, oh, nice shirt. Or you just, what would that's no use to anyone. So again, I'm a big believer in that you are what you do. And if you're frustrated that you're not getting the things you want to get, we'll look at how do they relate to what you spend the majority of your professional time doing. So a good example of that would be, I know of people who do a lot of TV warm-up, and it's a skill, and it's the only thing that makes me genuinely ill with nerves when I do it. I don't know why. I think it's because I did it too early and wasn't good at it. And it's not something I enjoy doing. However, I know people who think that's a way into getting on the show because there's that thing. Well, you know, Graham Norton used to do warm up for Jonathan Ross.
Mm-hmm.
And now look at him. You know, yeah, but that's not why he got. Ross Noble used to do warm up for Have I Got News For You?
Yeah.
But that's not why Ross Noble is Ross Noble. So if you sort of, and I've been frustrated in the past, you know, saying, oh, I've done TV warm up for this show, or I've done this gig and why aren't I getting that? Well, what skills that you are displaying are not what skills. Yeah. What skills that you're displaying are transferable to the thing you want to do? Because no one's going to say we want the compare for Live at the Apollo, even though it does have a compare. You know what I mean? No one goes, we want that guy who was really funny because he pointed out that Bath is posh and Bristol is not posh. We want to get him on to do the headlines for the Apollo because it would be a disaster. What if there's no one from Bath in? That said, Southwest, I'd say I'm one of the top four compares.
If you had to turn someone who was a perfectly decent, capable stand-up into a compare in 30 seconds, what would be the one bit of advice that you could give them? Like not completely from scratch, someone who's never gigged before, but someone who knows their way around a set.
Don't ask open questions.
Go on.
Always say...
Sorry, just to clarify, don't
ask open questions. Or do. Sometimes I do. Maybe I don't mean that. Don't always... Okay, let's start again. So the 30 seconds is now up.
Yeah.
they've gone to ask someone else.
They've just walked out on stage, died.
I think a good compere is someone who can have conversations with audience members, always open it up to the room. So always not just repeat the conversation to the room, but involve everyone in that conversation if they're having a chat with someone on the front row. Because otherwise, what are the people 10 rows back thinking? They can't hear what the man's saying. They can't see what the person's wearing or whatever. And allow the audience to make known amongst them who is willing to talk. So I always open with exactly the same thing. I say, welcome to the show. Yes, I'm handsome, John. And then I'll move on to, I don't say that. I'll move on, say, who's had a, give me a cheer if you had a good day. Bang. Give me a cheer if you had a shit day. And the person who cheers loudest for either of those things will be willing to talk to you and will 99% of the time say something which you can then spark off. The worst thing is to pick the sort of vulnerable person who's been forced to sit in the front row, who's staring at their feet and going, what do you do for a living? No. Come on, what do you do for a living? Oh, no, you wouldn't want to. By then, you look like a dick because you're not... But the person who goes, hey, when you say he's had a shit day, is more often than not likely to go, when you go, oh, what's wrong with your day? Work. Well, where do you work? I work at the place. Oh, he works at the bloody place. I work at that place. But then you're away, and then you're fine. And then it all sort of writes itself, and then you get into advanced level stuff with weaving gold in between answers, riding the applause, and just dropping bombs, which we'll have in our next 30-second lesson.
I feel like I hear in some of your casual kind of comedy chat...
A lot of wisdom.
I feel like I hear some... Like, there's a particular way of talking about comedy that a lot of comedians of our year at school, you know, of the last 10 years, you know, people who started... probably between 8 and 14 years ago.
Yeah.
Will refer to dropping bombs.
Yes.
And that kind of like almost like pseudo rap terminology. And
that we all got from Daniel Kitson.
That we all got from Daniel Kitson. Thank you. Yeah. Is that something you're aware of? It clearly is.
Yeah, but I mean, I've got so many, in terms of the way I speak, there are so many, you could pick apart a lot of sentences and go, well, that's Alan Partridge, that's Alan Partridge, that's Alan Partridge, that's Steve Coogan's other character, that's the day-to-day, that's Bottom, that's Kitson, that's Russell Howard, that's Adam Buxton and Joe Cornish. There's a lot, and I hope that, you know, 78% or above is John Robbins, but that, you know, there are bits that are, yeah, the other people. I had a bit in, three words in my last Edinburgh show, which were pure Acaster, pure boss.
Come on, what were the words?
Describing someone as a piece of work.
Yeah, that's 100% Acaster.
100% Acaster, and I know it, and I loved saying it because it always made me think, you think you're doing a piece of work? It's exactly the sort of thing he said. He would say, it may even be something he does say.
He does say that,
well,
yeah.
Then I am a terrible thief and write a chortle correspondence piece about me.
Do you think that you, I mean, I hear a lot of Partridge. I hear a lot of Partridge, yeah, in your waxing lyrical on the radio show.
Yeah.
Do you ever think that that's problematic? Do you ever think that you should try and strip that out?
No, because then I would be, because it is the way I speak to my friends, I can have entire conversations with my best friend about, say, for example, a relationship problem one of us might be having, and we can speak entirely about it in Alan Partridge quotes, and it'll end with one of us saying, still, good news about the chocolate oranges. And in order for me to remove that from my speech would take... Well, A, it wouldn't be me, weirdly, by not being Partridge, it wouldn't be me. But also, I would have to second guess everything I say. Also, when you're doing a trail for a competition to win an iPad or something, it's impossible not to, because he's based on so many other radio presenters. And also, what I think is brilliant about him is he's the perfect illustration of the fact that dead air is a crime. So Alan is funniest when he can't stop talking, because on radio you cannot stop talking, right? The minute you start thinking about what you're going to say is the minute you've stopped doing your job as a radio presenter. So the sentence begins and you follow it. And that is funny, because you end up saying there's two or three clauses in everything Alan Partridge says that are absolutely unnecessary, that get him into more sort of hot water than he would ever have been in had he just stopped. And I think that's the genius of it. But also, that's a very real factor in the radio, is that you open your mouth, because it's not, we don't script it. I know some people do, which strikes me as a mammoth ball ache to actually have to write down 23-minute links a day. Yeah. I don't know how people do that. It's amazing. So when you start talking, you have to carry on talking. But I would never, like, directly quote Partridge. I speak in a very Partridge-esque way sometimes.
Well, I thought when you did A Robin's Among the Pigeons, which, yes, was sensationally funny.
Thanks, man.
And is it available to download somewhere? Is there, like, a special that people can get? Because I know you read it out loud in some live events. I could never make one.
Yeah, so there is a podcast of all of The Robin's Amongst the Pigeons is in one. Okay. So it's read out in chunks on each podcast.
Yes, and it's your real diaries.
It's my autobiography written by me.
Okay. Oh, I see. So it wasn't from at the time. It's you looking back on those words.
Yeah.
Okay. About you being a young comic gigging in Bristol.
Well, my life.
Sure.
So okay. From birth to, I think what we get up to is the radio show with Ellis.
Okay.
So there's a podcast of all those bits edited together. There's also, you can buy the book, but not currently online. So that's it's going to be at the tour shows. You can buy it on the merch stand.
Sweet merch. Nice.
And we're going to be doing more live readings of that, but they've not been announced yet. But they will be in the coming months. But that was written in the style of Tony Blackburn's autobiography.
Okay.
Poptastic, which I also read out on the show. So you're talking, 30 chapters, 60 weeks I was providing content for that show while Ellis was basking in his sitcom. So I read out excerpts from Tony Blackburn's autobiography, Poptastic, which I would recommend to every human being. It is better, and I use this term advisedly, than I, Partridge, because I, Partridge is in part based on Tony Blackburn. And I mentioned that the only time I've ever met Steve Coogan, I got very, very overawed and was grinning like a mad idiot. And I just said, Steve, was Tony Blackburn's autobiography a kicking off point for Alan Partridge? And he went, I think he may have been a reference point. And I went, yeah, because there's a bit in his book. And then I quoted a passage from Tony Blackburn's as if like, and Steve Coogan sat there going, yeah, who are you again in this dressing room? As my girlfriend's in the dressing room, I'm just sort of with her to hang out like a cool dude. But there are bits from Alan Partridge's character which are taken from Tony Black. There's a bit in Tony Blackburn's book where he gets advised to lower the octave of his speech, which Des Lynam tells Alan Partridge to sort of lower down the nasality. And there's a couple of other sort of funny bits that have reappeared in Partridge. So my book is based on his book, which Alan Partridge's book is in part reflective of. So I haven't stolen anyone's ideas apart from Tony Blackburn's.
Thank you. Lovely. Do you feel comfortable talking about your Stuart Lee material?
Yes, I feel comfortable talking about my Stuart Lee material.
It's very funny.
Thanks, man.
It's on This Tornado Loves You.
Yes.
And it's in the beginning 10 minutes or so.
Yeah.
And you do a routine about Stuart Lee. What is it? Describe what it is. It's a routine in the style of Stuart Lee about Stuart Lee.
So it's in context of a bit. So the show is broadly about being happy with a new girlfriend. I'm delighted to say it's still my current girlfriend. And how that is sort of useless to mine for comedy. Happiness is not a useful topic for comedy. And then I make an observation that the happier, more successful comedians become, the more they need to pretend to be miserable in order to have comedy. And that then led very nicely into a bit about Stuart Lee, about his basically a knowing pastiche of his style and logic, but applied to him, which I thought was an interesting comedic avenue, which the comedian John Robbins stands by absolutely.
Do you think Stuart Lee has kind of become the comedy police?
No. I think there was a time at which he became, I'm not saying he intended for this to be the case. It's difficult because in writing that bit of material, which I stand by, when people ask me about it, the few people who have or stuff on podcasts or things, I think what they sort of want is for me to then slag off Stuart Lee, which the reason I wrote that bit is to so that I wouldn't have to do that because that's not my intention. My intention was to punch up, you know, as soon as someone sets themselves up for whatever reason as a sort of the arbiter of what's acceptable or not in comedy. I find that an interesting and it's natural instinct to go, okay, well, how do you fit into that world you've created? And as it turns out, we're all part of the same hypocrisy, to quote, I believe, The Godfather.
You mean Ricky Gervais? No, I know you don't mean
that. So we're all part of the same hypocrisy. I think maybe a Godfather too. Anyway.
What you mean in the sense that there could now be a newer act doing a bit of material based on your bit of material? Like, here's a bit of John Robbins.
No, not in that sense.
In the style of John Robbins.
But as soon as you criticise another comedian, which is absolutely anyone's right to do, and I do think his bit on
Pasquale.
Yes. I think just in terms of form is one of the best jokes, best routines I've ever heard. He will now then, no doubt, because he now refers to me as the people who hate my material but agree with all my opinions or something like that. There's a bit.
He refers to you personally as...
Well, his response has shocked me in its petulance. However, it's quite amusing to hear yourself referred to as an XFM twat by a man who should be far more comfortable in their own skin. And they looked down the lens on a bit of a comedy vehicle and said, you know who you are. And part of me was sat at home thinking, oh, Oh, do I? I don't know where that is. Maybe.
How did that make you feel to think that might have been you?
Because well, luckily, I, being a friend of Russell Howard's, I knew exactly what to expect. anyway, I'm not saying that is me. Because then that becomes a sort of reverse boast, doesn't it? Sort of be a, like, that. Yeah, it becomes a sort of a humble brag, I guess. Stuart Lee is as much a product as I am, or Mark Watson is, or Frankie Boyle is. They're just marketed in different ways. So it's sort of nonsense to cast aspersions on everyone else's decisions. I mean, there are certain things that absolutely, you know, I have personally said to comics who've been in adverts that I found irresponsible. I've said that I think that is a terrible advert. I've not said you shouldn't do it because you're an actor or that's your job. That's how people make their living. But I've said I think I fundamentally disagree with that advert you did, and I think it's dangerous.
Like what? You don't need to identify the person or the product, but what? I don't quite understand what you mean that it's something dangerous, like a gambling advert.
Yes,
to me.
Oh, yeah, like right. Misleading and
okay.
And so I would be perfectly happy, but I would never feel the need to personally criticize a person for being in an advert because that's madness. Whereas that, I just haven't watched any Bill Hicks. Maybe I should. Should I be more angry? I haven't actually. But yeah, so some people asked me about that routine because I think at the time... No, you asked me, is Stuart Lee the Comedy Police? I don't think he is, and I don't think he's setting himself out to be. I just think at the time when I wrote that, it chimed with what a lot of comedians felt about him because they see the side of the industry that other people don't see. And I think there are a sort of portion of comedy fans who seem to get all their opinions about comedy from Stuart Lee. Now, I don't think he's not telling them to do that, but they just think, well, we are fans and familiar with the work of the best comedian, in our opinion, therefore Russell Howard, all these other people, Frankie Boyle, they're all rubbish because Stuart Lee told us so. Only thing, I think it's slightly more nuanced than that, which is the point of that material, and which is why I think the material sort of stands on its own. Which sort of makes some of his reactions to it slightly baffling. If the comedian Stuart Lee was true, that is a persona, then the person Stuart Lee would surely be far more comfortable with other people's interpretation of the comedian Stuart Lee, because according to him, it's an artistic sort of conversation we're having, because I'm a person with a persona putting across a point of view which I can either... say I agree with or not, depending on how I feel. However, if someone then takes that at face value and goes, okay, I'm going to quite that in the sort of Chaucerian sense, I'm going to create a response to that in an artistic forum, not on Twitter, not on Facebook, then surely if that's a persona, an artist persona, then they go, huh, I see you're quite. That was very interesting artistically. Not to then get really pissed off and start calling them a twat. Because that's someone who is offended that the fact that the thing they said has been sort of mocked, which seems ludicrous if it's sort of a solely an artistic endeavour. I went to school with Joel, so I claim ownership of everything he does.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know you went to school with Joel. Joel was a nutcase at school, was he?
No.
No?
He was a very pleasant and obedient drama student who I directed in the school play.
Did you? Yeah. The more I learn about what Joel got up to in his spare time, maybe it wasn't at school that he was a nutcase. I don't
well, with Joel, where Joel. Does the truth end and the myth begin? That's what you got to ask yourself.
That is an excellent in-joke for big listeners of this show.
Is it?
Yeah, we talked about that a lot in the episode we
did. Oh, did you?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's my thing of putting it to him. I find it harder to watch him now I know it might all be a lie.
Yeah, but I mean, that's true of an awful lot of comedians, isn't it?
How
don't you ever sit through a show and think, that never happened, you know,
never happened, that never happened, never happened, yep. Happened, but not to you.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you? What's your relationship to the truth?
That's a question that needs to be asked in an American stoned accent. My relationship to the truth. Tell you what, there's James May was once asked if Top Gear was...
First time he's begun a sentence on this podcast, do go on.
If Top Gear was real, and he said... What was it? He said, is it... Yeah, he said, is everything that happens on Top Gear true? And he said, it's all true, but some of it's not real. Or it might have been the other way around. Either way, it was very profound.
Yes.
Because what he was saying is... He said, it's all... Yeah, he said, it's all true, but some of it's not real, I think. And I think that's a very good way of describing my relationship with the truth, probably. If I have never thought that I had one before. So, for example, I will take a story and keep telling it and telling it and telling it until it's I've found all the funny points. A bit like when people say, oh, how do you remember stand-up? How do you know what you're going to say next? It's like when you're at a pub with your friends and they say, go on, tell the story about Keith.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, which one? They go, you know, the one about Keith at the party. And you go, oh, okay, I'll tell the story about Keith at the party. And some of those people have heard it and some of it haven't. But you remember all of the things in that story that everyone wants to hear. So the story becomes differently emphasized to the actual story of Keith at the party.
Yes.
Things get blown out of proportion. Things get added in. Certain things that were said get rearranged into a more satisfying way to tell or hear. But the fact is, Keith still went to a party. You know, there's still an incident. But you just happen to have told it in the most satisfying way. And some of those things, Keith may well go, yeah, but we know that didn't actually happen.
Yes.
You know, there's an infamous story of a comedian in Edinburgh being... someone is pleasuring him hand-wise. And the story goes... They're in a kitchen, and just before he's about to orgasm, he says, aim for the sink or we're doomed. Now, everyone who's ever heard that story knows that that is not what he said, because no one would say that. However, it fits absolutely perfect with the person it is, and as far as I'm concerned, that's the story.
Yes.
And that's the story I will continue to tell.
Absolutely. Because the empirical truth is less important than the truth of the story.
Because someone saying, oh, point at the sink, I don't want to clean this up, is not a funny story. That's a harrowing story.
Yes.
But someone saying, aim for the sink or we're doomed, is a great story.
You are the one of the two key figures in possibly my favourite backstage story.
Really?
Yes. The story about Reg Hunter.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, I used to do stand-up about that.
Did you? Did you really? I don't know whether I'd heard the story from you or from your set. I don't think I heard you do it on stage.
I used to do it on stage, and it never got into an Edinburgh show because someone once... I did it on either... I think I did it on some either radio show or a... Maybe I even told it on Alan Davis. But then someone tweeted me... John Robbins using Reg D. Hunter to finish his punchlines, because the story ends with Reg saying something very funny.
Yes.
And immediately I got sad. Like one tweet ended the existence of that.
No, it's a wonderful story. Did you do it on Alan Davies then? I won't ask you to repeat it here if you did.
Oh, this was ages ago.
Okay.
But and also it's very strange when someone asks you to tell them a story, which you then put into stand-up.
Yes.
I don't want to do stand-up at you.
Absolutely. And you, how do you tell the story without doing all the best beats that you've that you've worked out over time?
I mean, it would take 7 minutes to do the story.
I think I told it in two the other day, but I think I...
I accidentally drank Reg D. Hunter's piss out of a pint glass, and I told him this, and... I mean, we're missing out so many great turns of phrase, but... I told him backstage, and he said, well, for about 2 or 3 weeks, you're going to be one funny motherfucker. And that's the end of the story. And then someone tweeted, but that punchline's Reg D. Hunter's. And I'm like, yeah, but I credit him.
Yeah, I mean, you were there. You drank the urine, and you admitted on stage you drank the urine.
God. Yeah, that was in the Pleasance One, but at the uni gig there.
And you funnier for 2 or 3 weeks after...
Oh, so many things I nearly said just then. No, I wasn't.
Last one. And I ask this of lots of people, and I might...
What's it like having a famous girlfriend? It's fine.
No. Oh, that's what you have. What you have reminded me of is a lovely little question. What's it like being a man in comedy?
I feel very marginalised. There's not many spaces for us anymore. being a man in comedy. Interesting. Because there are, especially for a white middle-class man, there are remarkably few new spaces on shows, but that's entirely right. So I've never been angry about that. In terms of what we were talking about earlier about sort of why am I not doing this, I've never thought, well, she's getting it because she's a woman, or he's getting it because he's Asian. Because it's absolutely appropriate that A, TV reflects the audience it has, which it doesn't do enough, and also that you have a plurality of voices in comedy. And I remember once I saw Ava Vidal, my first gig with her, at the Bath Comedia, and it would have been about 2008, and I'd never met before, and I watched her stand-up, and I was like, I have never seen those opinions from that point of view on stage anywhere ever. And I will never use race or ethnicity or gender as a sort of an excuse for why someone got a thing, because I've never consumed that before comedically. So, you know, put them on everything. That's what I say. but on the other hand of that, it's not since meeting my girlfriend, who's also a comedian, that I have fully understood how difficult an experience it is being a woman in comedy. Because I've always thought, well, I have been guilty of thinking, okay, so someone makes the odd comment, yeah, deal with it. You know, because if you are a comedian who happens to be a female, if you suffer from that from that problem, then, you know, you've got quite a good chance of getting decent exposure, because there aren't enough of them and we need more of those voices. And we need 50% of the population to be represented by 50% of comedians, ideally. I mean, I'm not in a sort of, not in an official capacity, but, you know, that makes perfect sense. But I didn't realize how hard it was. Just stuff like the way you're treated by other acts at gigs, men at gigs, fucking around with the lights and the sound while you're on, being forced to share rooms with promoters because they've somehow the hotel's fallen through. So now you're sleeping in a room with them, which you have no choice other than to do that because the last train's gone. Not being told that the train is a 5-mile walk from the gig when they give you the details over a dark industrial estate. You know, all these little things that, as a man, if I have to kip on someone's sofa, that's fine. If I have to walk through, you know, a dark bit, that's fine. You know, if someone fucks with the lights, I go, what the fuck are you doing fucking with the lights, you piece of shit? You know, I just, all these things are like, oh, I see why that's, the process of it is much more difficult. So being a man in comedy is easy.